Okay, so I was supposed to talk on Wednesday in the heterogeneity session with Alan Garfinkel, who did a very nice job of talking about the dynamical heterogeneity and its relationship to the anatomical heterogeneity. So now that I'm in the restitution session, I thought I ought to talk about something other than that, and I wasn't really sure what I was going to talk about. So I made a list of things that I'm involved in at the moment. And it's a long list, so I figured, well, I'd be able to find something there. And then I thought about it a little more. And so the first topic is maximizing dynamically induced heterogeneity. And Neil Zatani talked about that in the first week of the conference. And then virtual electrodes. Valentin gave the theory. Stefan gave the experiments in the second week. And locating and tracking phase singularities. Eberhard talked about this. Building ionic models. Elizabeth talked about that. Controlling local action potential duration dynamics. Alain presented the theory and talked about some of the experiments that we've done in collaboration with Dave Christini. And then investigating the role of APD and CV restitution. Flavio is going to talk about that again at 2 o'clock today. And probably if I said anything about restitution this morning, he would contradict it this afternoon. So I'm going to stay away from that, sort of. And then the last one is insect cyborg sentinels. And that has nothing to do with cardiac dynamics, so that's why I'm going to talk about it for a couple of minutes. My other excuse is that this project is supported by DARPA, and DARPA gave us some money for this workshop, even though the DARPA guy was on here for about an hour. So, yes. In fact, I have the movies, but I'm not going to show those. Anyway, 2 minutes on this, just because I sort of think it's cool. What we're going to do is to instrument Manduca moths, which have a wingspan of like that, with MEMS devices so that we can navigate them into whatever cave Osama bin Laden is hiding and and say, gotcha. And so this is the pupal stage of the moth. Yeah. And it has some LED goggles, so this provides visual cues for navigation. It has some microfluidics and nanospritzers to put pheromones in front of it for hormonal navigation. And then it has this MEMS version of a rectal thermometer, which has a large number of electrodes on it to stimulate and record. And believe it or not, we've actually done this part already, and we can get the moths. They hover before they take off, so they flap in phase to stay in place because they have to generate enough heat to get off the ground. And then they flap out of phase when they fly, so we've, by hook and by crook, been able to make them stop and start. This, I'm sorry?
How big is the body?
Oh, like that. That this long, maybe this wide.
The label is going to be like a cornet.
And Flavio's already developed a computer simulation of one that has a little rocket that it'll fire. But.
Inject the neurotoxin or something.
Right. So this thing has to be powered, so there's a little battery, and when the wings flap, that charges the battery. And it has a GPS antenna, so we can find this thing and interrogate it and see what it's found. And I'm sorry? It's a microelectrical mechanical system, so just really small circuitry. And we're going to mass produce these things.
What are these people in the Robert, can you go back?
Well, these are the LED guys. Yeah, the LEDs are to. The moths navigate in three ways. They navigate visually, they navigate via hormones, and they also navigate via sonar, or they're sensitive to sonar because they're predated by bats. So when the bats echolocate them, they know that. And so if the wavefront is, the echo wave is coming this way, then they go that way and vice versa. So that's another way to get them to navigate. We haven't figured out exactly yet how we're going to simulate the sonar sensitivity that they have. Eyes and pheromones, and then directly stimulating their wing muscles.
Do they carry a camera?
No, not yet. The payload is somewhat limited, but we have located some very large moths in Costa Rica, and they're about this big. So if we can capture enough of those, then maybe we can put more stuff on them. But anyway, you can developmentally arrest the pupae, so you can keep them in this stage at sort of moth LAX here for as long as you want, and then take them out into the field and add water, and you get moths that supposedly go where they're going to go and do what they're supposed to do. So anyway, that's our insect cyborg sentinels. So if you see something that looks a little strange flying around about a year from now, be careful. All right, but it doesn't have anything to do with heart dynamics, although the engineers thought it did at the beginning, but I talked them out of that.
All right. I heard a couple of stories recently. One, I think I heard basically the same author before, one in PRC, so she has been probing into DARPA funding and crazy DARPA projects.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe I might hear about this one, but there's stuff that's been funded that's made for years.
No. This is pretty sedate compared to some of the things that they're doing. Got to see what they're doing with the bees. So, all right. So what's left?
Well,
I'm sorry.
The power, the harvesting power unit, is that solar energy or something?
Yeah, so it's solar energy, but it's also, I'm going to put flippers on the wings, so when the wings flap, then the flippers will move, and that energy will then be translucent into the battery. And again... right. Yeah, so... But you know, there's no free lunch. So the moths also then will have microfluidic glucose on board, so they can get fed while they're on this. Yeah.
Is it really like the rectum for moths that is inside their digestive tract?
No. Luckily they have space in the pupal stage before they start to expand to grow. And so you can get this thing in. Whether the moths ever going to really fly with all this stuff attached to it, I don't know. So far they have, but we haven't put everything on them yet. All right, so what's left to talk about? Lunch, but all right. So I'm gonna go back to item number one, which was the one that Niels talked about, and that is maximizing heterogeneity dynamically to facilitate the induction of conduction block and reentry. The idea that maybe if we understand how that works or how it can work, that might help us to understand how arrhythmias get started. And so I'm going to do reentry 101 here just briefly for people who don't think about this all the time. And if you want to induce a reentrant wave, you typically need three things. You need unidirectional conduction block. So a wave of propagation has to encounter some region that's refractory and another region that's not. And then it needs to conduct slowly through that region that was not refractory so that it re-excites the previously blocked region after it's had time for its refractory period to expire. And I'm going to focus on the unidirectional conduction block part of this story. And with respect to creating unidirectional conduction block, you need some mechanism for heterogeneity of refractoriness. Now, as Alan already pointed out, that might be anatomical. You have a scar someplace or diseased tissue. Or it could be functional in the sense of it being an intrinsic property of the tissue, endocardium being different from M cells, being different from endocardium. Or it could be dynamically induced, where you have a tissue that's homogeneous, but it develops heterogeneity in response to certain patterns of stimulation. And that's the one that I'm going to focus on. And again, as Alan has already told you, dynamical heterogeneity results from several causes, but probably the two primary players are rate-dependent processes known as restitution of action potential duration and of conduction velocity. And APD restitution in its simplest incarnation, I'm going to start very simply here and stay simple for a while, and I apologize for those people that are going to be really bored, but later on it'll get more complicated and hopefully correspondingly more interesting. But in its simplest form, the duration of this action potential then is strictly a function of the preceding diastolic interval, and if you accept that notion, then you can predict the dynamics of action potential duration simply by iterating a unidimensional map. And in this case, we have a restitution relation. Action potential duration is a function of preceding diastolic interval for some pacing cycle length, in this case 150 milliseconds. And this particular relationship has a slope that is nowhere greater than 1. And again, as Alan told you, the fixed point here, which is the intersection of the BCL line with the function, is stable. So no matter where you start out here, you're going to end up at this point. And then we'll have a one-to-one rhythm where each stimulus generates an action potential with the same duration. On the other hand, if there's a region of slope greater than 1, this intersection now is an unstable fixed point. You have a period doubling bifurcation, so instead of having one-to-one, you have two-to-two behavior where you have an alternation of long and short action potentials. And under the appropriate experimental conditions, this actually happens. these data that happen to be from our lab, a number of other labs have shown this kind of behavior. And here Marcus Kohler stimulated dog endocardium in vitro at shorter and shorter basic cycle lengths and recorded the steady state response. And if the cycle length was long enough, the steady state response was 1-to-1. And beyond some basic cycle length, we have the bifurcation and an alternans or a 2-to-2 pattern. And if you plot all of these APDs versus their preceding diastolic intervals, you get a unidimensional relationship with a slope 1. And we've been having some discussions as to whether the alternans results from the slope being 1 or whether the slope results from the alternans. But I'm not going to get into that today. Maybe Flavio will. Turns out the same sort of thing can be demonstrated in humans. This is Marcus Kohler again, but instead of being in the dog lab, he's now in the cath lab in Würzburg. And he studied a total of 36 patients, 12 of, and these were patients that were being evaluated for syncope of unknown origin. In other words, were passing out, and they wanted to find out why. 12 of them did not have structural heart disease, 24 did. Of those 24, 17 were ischemic cardiomyopathy. So this is action potential duration as measured by a monophasic action potential catheter in the right ventricle, in the apex of the right ventricle. And this is the APD then versus diastolic interval when he paced these patients at progressively shorter cycle lengths as we did with the dog myocardium. And two things came out of this. Number one, there was a restitution relation. And these are the patients with no structural heart disease. These are the patients who had structural heart disease. And their slopes were steeper at longer diastolic intervals. And this was manifest then as the appearance of APD alternans. So now he's pacing at different beats per minute. So this is faster pacing. As he paces faster, you can see that there's an onset of APD alternans in the person with structural heart disease. In the person without heart disease, at least in the ventricles, as you pace faster, you don't see alternans until you pace quite fast. So this slope only becomes 1 then at very short diastolic intervals for the patients without disease. With disease, it becomes 1 sooner. And obviously, there's a limitation here with these patients in that you can't pace them too fast, or you pace them into ventricular fibrillation, which is typically what we do with the dogs. So we don't really know what it looks like out here. It might even be steeper than what we were able to determine with these people. Okay, so that's the simplest story, and of course that pulse story, as everyone knows. So when you look at restitution and AP dynamics, what we've been talking about is the steady state curve, which is this dotted line representing the relationship between duration and preceding diastolic interval. But there are various ways to probe the real restitution relation, and the one that I think is very valuable has been developed by Dan Dowdier's group with Wanda Krasowska and Vanda Tokocheva. And what they do is to pace at some fixed cycle length and get a steady state behavior and then perturb off of that for one cycle length, either shorter or longer, and record the APD in response to that single perturbation. And then they change the cycle length and hold it and observe the transition into the next steady state. When they perturb off of that, go to the next, perturb off of, and allow that to come to steady state, etc. And so what you get then is this what's called a restitution portrait, which tells you what the steady state values are, they tell you what the immediate transients are, and they give you some idea of what the memory component is for a given tissue. And we've been doing this now in our, this was from frog myocardium, we've been doing it in the dog myocardium, and has a somewhat different quantitative look, but qualitatively it's similar. And so what you'll notice is that you don't really have a restitution relation anymore in terms of a unidimensional relationship. What you have is this corridor of values. And so we've been talking a little bit about what APD looks like during ventricular fibrillation when you have lots of changes in cycle length. And you can imagine that you could be bouncing around down in this region of short diastolic interval during ventricular fibrillation. And then if you add on to that catecholamines being released and curvature and other effects, I think you can understand why a lot of the VF APD DI maps look pretty messy. At least I can understand that. Okay, so that's APD restitution. We also need to worry about CV restitution. So this is just a schematic of a CV restitution curve here and an APD restitution curve here. And I put this up solely to make the point that if at a certain cycle length you may have each beat, and these are pairs of values during alternans. You have the CV that's the same for both beats, despite the fact that the APDs are alternating long, short, long, short. On the other hand, if you pick a shorter cycle length, now you can have alternation of both. So now the CV is alternating from fast, slow, fast, slow, at the same time that the APD is alternating from large, small, large, small. And this has important implications for the development of spatial dynamics, as Colleen has showed you and Alan has showed you as well. But let me just take you through this one more time, just to make sure we're all in the same place. Here we have a fiber. This is the proximal end. This is the distal end. We're stimulating the proximal end. We have an action potential. It propagates over some period of time, delta t, and appears at the distal end. We deliver the next stimulus after a long diastolic interval. Everything's had time to recover, so the action potential conducts with the same speed as it did here, and it shows up at the distal site, just simply delta t out of phase with the proximal site. If we shorten the diastolic interval, now the action potential duration of the second response is shorter than that of the first response, so we have APD alternans, but the diastolic interval is still long enough that the sodium channels had sufficient time to recover, and so the conduction velocity is not affected. So delta T's here are the same as they are here, and long short at this end shows up as long short at this end. However, if we shorten the diastolic interval even more, now we impinge on the refractory period, the relative refractory period. We have a short action potential duration, but we're also going to have slow conduction. So instead of this action potential appearing at the end when it would have if the conduction velocity had been the same as normal, the slower conduction velocity means that the diastolic interval at the distal site is going to be longer than it was at the proximal site, which means this action potential is going to be longer than this one, and the succeeding diastolic interval is going to be shorter than here. So we set up this discordant pattern where short goes to long, and then this next long one is going to get short. Okay, so that's review. And again, this sort of thing really happens. This is a study we had several years ago where we took a dog Purkinje fiber, which in the heart is about the closest approximation to a unidimensional cable. We stimulated one end at a constant cycle length and recorded from, in this case, four sites simultaneously using microelectrodes. And you can see that at this particular cycle length, at this particular time, we have a pattern of short, long, near the stimulating electrode, but not too far away, about a half a centimeter or so. We have discordant alternans, so this is long, short, long, short. So the long action potential then conducts here, arrives early, creates a short action potential that conducts slowly, and in fact, eventually, it conducts decrementally so that you have 2-to-1 conduction block at the distalmost site. So here we have a relatively homogeneous cable. We're pacing it at a constant cycle length, but yet we've got fairly complicated dynamics in that we've got discordant alternans at one end of the fiber, 2-to-1 block at the other. And you can then hypothesize that if this fiber were connected to a bunch of other fibers and they weren't all exactly the same, that the 2-to-1 block might occur in one place but not in another, and that would then set the stage for reentry. All right, and you can understand what's happening here, or at least one way to understand it, is simply to look at these restitution relations and these so-called cobweb diagrams. So this is the depiction of discordant alternans along a fiber. This is the one that Alan doesn't like. And so you have a long action potential that gets shorter, and you have a short action potential that gets longer on alternating beats. And then in the middle, there's a node. So what's going on near the site of stimulation? Well, this is the restitution relation for action potential duration, now d, as a function of diastolic interval I. And this is our pacing cycle length, which in this case is 220 milliseconds. So we iterate this, and we get long, short, long, short. Okay. But as this short action potential travels along the fiber, it's going to travel slowly, which means that the time, the effective period at this point in the fiber is not what we're pacing at, 220, but is somewhat longer or somewhat shorter, depending upon whether this region has been invaded by a rapidly conducting long action potential or a slowly conducting short action potential. And the pattern of iteration here is this duration goes to this cycle length, this duration goes to this, and what you have then is a compression of the APD alternans, so that the alternans magnitude here is less than it is here, and you can imagine as you move toward the region of the node, it gets even less and less until it disappears entirely, and that is the node. As you emerge on the other side of the node, the pattern of iteration reverses, so now the longer action potential iterates to the shorter cycle length and vice versa. And this has the result that you amplify the alternans. So the alternans magnitude here is larger than at the site of stimulation, although it's not immediately apparent from the diagram. Now, if the fiber is long enough, this then forms another node, and you go on and on.
And you need two restitution curves, because right at the node you have the same D with two different cycle lengths.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that you can have that is if you actually have a cycle between two different curves of cycle lengths and two different restitution curves. And that's why the electrodes are talking that different on top of the break. It's impossible just to construct a closed cycle right at the node from the curves you draw.
Yeah. Good point. But the difference between these two restitution curves at that point can be minute.
Well, it's got to be exactly to balance. It's exactly to balance the difference of cycle length.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that minute. That's the point.
Cycle length should be the same. This is a station.
No, you have an antinode of cycle length right there. That's what it's showing you. That's why you have these two blue curves.
Mm-hmm.
So the cycle length is oscillating right at the node.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that difference of timing is exactly the same that you get from the difference in the
cycle length should be the same other way across the fiber, because otherwise it would be accumulated.
Well, average, we're not talking average. Bit to bit, it's oscillating to these two curves, and we have two red curves so that you get,
Actually, also here, as I said, the more nodes you have, the more stronger is this current that has to go back and forth. So the more nodes you have, the speaking of the atoms of the restriction becomes larger and larger.
Mm-hmm.
So the electronic effect, I mean, speaking, Peter Rutter can speak to what it is, but can speak it for 20, 35 milliseconds.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So where does the block come from? The block comes from the fact that if you shorten the cycle length, you increase the magnitude of the alternans at the site of stimulation, which is then going to be even greater magnitude distal to the node. And so now your long action potential iterates to some diastolic interval where there's no excitability available, and so there's no action potential, and one gets 2-to-1 block. Now, just to follow up, I don't have the slides in here, but you know, what happens next is that if you have 2-to-1 block, let me back up. If and when this block's distal to the node, this then opens up and you have a smaller magnitude of alternans at the site of stimulation, as because the node is precessing towards the site of stimulation. And what that does then is allow you to recapture this region down the fiber. And you can do this over and over again. So this is a cyclical. All right, so I'm showing you this because I'm going to come back to this in a different context later, and I know this is very elementary, but hopefully it'll get less so later. All right, so up until now, what I've been talking about is just pacing cardiac tissue at a constant cycle length, the constant short cycle length, and you get this transition from concordant alternans to discordant alternans to conduction block. But that's probably not very relevant for the induction of real arrhythmias. We're not going to pace somebody at 10 hertz, and they're not going to have a sinus tachycardia or a VT at that rate. But so what's potentially more relevant is the introduction of several premature stimuli at different cycle lengths. And as I'm going to try to convince you that the same dynamics applies here. So this is a simulation from an ionic model. This is the pre-Schiff Fox model. And what we're doing is stimulating a cable at a constant cycle length, and you haven't seen the preceding beats. And then we deliver a premature stimulus, S2, at a very short diastolic interval. And of course, because the diastolic interval is short, the action potential duration is short, and this action potential is going to conduct slowly, which is reflected then in an increase in the diastolic interval as you move down the fiber, and that is associated with an increase in the action potential duration distally. So we started with a short action potential, and we ended up with a longer action potential. If we then program this so that we wait a little bit and give a certain period of diastolic interval and stimulate again, now this action potential will have fully recovered sodium channels, it will conduct rapidly, and it will, in effect, catch up or impinge on the wave back of this previous wavefront. So now the diastolic interval starts long, gets shorter, that's associated with a short action potential. And we can keep doing this. Here's a closely coupled S4 that's short and slow, leading to a longer action potential. And then if we put in the S5 at the right time, it will conduct rapidly and now collide with the wave back of this previous wave and extinguish. And this is what we've called type 2 conduction block, as distinguished from conduction block at the site of stimulation. So the block's not occurring here where we're stimulating, it's occurring somewhere down the fiber because of this oscillatory APD dynamics.
Is this being done in a model that gives rise to the dynamic restitution forfeit using the
protocol? Yeah, so that's... We're trying to do that, but we haven't so far. So we're still in the data collection stage, because if you go to Eighth Beta, it's Frog, and you know, frogs are different, and they have huge alternans and very different kinds of memory. So we've been accumulating data in the dog to try to then create a model that will reproduce that, and Niels has been working on that.
But this is from a model, and that model doesn't reproduce that?
It reproduces some of it, but not all of it. So we don't think we have the memory right in this model. Well, we didn't put memory into this model, it just runs.
It might be there.
Yep. Yeah, there is memory in this model, but we don't, you know, introduce it. What we do introduce memory into is this model, and we've been using this to create, to conduct the simulations that I'm going to show you, because the ionic model has the right behavior, but it just takes a long time to scan lots and lots of sequences of premature stimuli, and I'm going to tell you why we did that in a minute. So instead we've been using this model, which is still a simple model, except that here now the duration of the action potential is not solely a function of the preceding diastolic interval, it's also a function of this memory quantity, which we've modeled somewhat arbitrarily as something that increases during the action potential and decreases between action potentials. So if the next stimulus were out here someplace, there would be no memory because it would have dissipated. On the other hand, if we stimulate more rapidly, the memory then tends to accumulate, and that affects the dynamics. And this is a model that Jeff Fox worked out. So what we did was to take this model and then stimulate it, have a unidimensional cable of cells constructed with that model, stimulate it at a fixed cycle length, and then introduce a number of premature stimuli. We started with 1, and then went to 3, and 5, and 7, and so I'm just going to show you the results where we have an S2 through an S5. And what we did was to deliver all possible combinations of these, so it was several million, and then identify which combinations produce this type 2 conduction block, which produce block somewhere along the fiber. And then we plotted those, and there were 67,000 of those. And then we plotted those to find out, well, were they randomly distributed or was there some pattern, some preferential pattern of stimuli that would induce the block? And there was a preferential pattern as shown by this histogram, so they tend to crowd or group where this peaks. And let me explain this diagram to you because it's not necessarily intuitive. What we're plotting is the S2 interval required to get block as a function of S2 min, which essentially is the refractory period. All right, so the closer you are to zero, the closer you are to refractoriness for this S2 stimulus. And the same thing for the S3 stimulus. So this is how far from refractoriness you are from the S3 stimulus. And obviously we can't show S4 and S5 because we don't have the dimensions to do that. But what this tells you in a nutshell is that if you want to get block, your S2 interval has to be very short. But your S3 interval shouldn't be short. It should be out here around 40 or 50 milliseconds after the refractory period. So there should be a short cycle length followed by a long cycle length.
And this is true no matter which S4 and S5
you're in. No. I'm going to get to that. So the same is true for the S4, S5. So the S4 needs to be close, and the S5, there you have more leeway in terms of whether it needs to be very close or somewhat further away.
What about spatial component? How much muscle do you need?
Yeah, so this is simply this
block you need to propagate some distance.
Yeah, and I'll get to that in a minute, but this simulation is simply a unidimensional cable of 200 cells.
200, so what is it?
So that's about 2 centimeters.
2 centimeters.
Yep.
So the S3 minimum, is it the same as the 2 minimum or it's different?
It's different. So we determine each one of these individually. So we deliver the S1, then deliver the S2 until we hit refractoriness, then come out 40 milliseconds, and then bring in the S3 until we hit refractoriness.
So the S3 minimum should be
or S2?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
S3 medium should depend on S2.
Yes, it does. Okay, so again, this is a, as you'll see in a minute, we've mimicked these intervals to at least approximate what's done clinically.
Eliminate the ones in which S3 might lead to the blocking.
Yes, we have here, but you can have a separate plot that looks exactly the same except that there are fewer of them. And you can even do it with the S1, but then there are much fewer of them. And if you have two more prematures, then you get a bigger one. So,
Sorry to be playing in the neck, but have you actually looked how far this block develops in terms of distance?
Okay, yeah, so I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. The fiber is about 2 centimeters long, right, and the block occurs about a third of the way down the fiber.
Well, then, in your life, you will have probably taken into account also virtual electric effect.
The what?
The virtual electric effect, because the closer fiber and the longer fiber, especially if you have a very short diastolic interval, so virtual electric effect will be about probably a quarter of your effect.
Yeah, except here we're stimulating about the first 20 cells in the cable.
When you go to tissue, should play a role there.
Yeah, that could be. I don't know. We haven't tried this in anything other than a Purkinje fiber yet. Well, and a whole dog, which you're going to see in a minute. Okay, so what that model told us was the same thing that this model told us, and that is if we want to get this kind of block, one way to do it is to use this short, long sequence. So, let me see. Yeah, before I get to that. All right, so that's nice.
It's like resonant pacing, right? So you're sort of amplifying the alternate.
Right. So what we're trying to do is amplify this oscillation by selecting the right cycle lengths. All right, so what does this have to do with anything? This was what we intended to be the initial step in a sequence of studies where we would do this in a model, then we do it in a Purkinje fiber, then we'd make a 2D model, then we'd try it in 2D myocardium or in the intact ventricle in vitro, expecting that we'd have to modify lots of things because this is unidimensional. It's homogeneous. It's everything the heart is not. So how can this have any chance of pertaining to a real heart? Yes?
What happens after S5? After S5, what do you do?
Yeah, I'll show you that in a second. But as luck would have it, Marcus Kohler was visiting me shortly after we put this together, and for another reason that I'll talk about in a minute. And we were doing some closed chest whole study. So these are anesthetized dogs. They've been instrumented for blood pressure. We've got catheters in them to stimulate and to record monophasic action potentials. And so I asked him to do this type of pacing in the whole dog. And this is the result. So this is the right ventricular monophasic action potential, left ventricular. We're pacing the right ventricle. We've been pacing at a constant cycle length of 400 milliseconds. And then we introduce this sequence of stimuli, short, long, short, intermediate. And you'll notice that initially the left ventricular action potential is longer than the right ventricle, but when we stimulate at a short diastolic interval, the short action potential shows up in the left ventricle as long, the longer one is shorter, the short one is longer, the intermediate one is intermediate, and then something happens, conduction block presumably, and VF. And these intervals then were the same intervals that were predicted from the model, and the model was based on in vitro dog data. In fact, it was based on in vitro beagle data, and these are beagles. So this is our beagle model, and amazingly, this worked every time. So this is the prediction from the model. These are the stimuli that we used in each. So this is 8 dogs. And we did this repetitively in the 8 dogs, and every time we did it, we fibrillated them.
What
now,
the
table? Yeah, right. So there are several million of those, and we didn't get a chance to try them all. But we did do what the clinicians would do. So this, I asked Marcus to try to induce VET like he would induce it in the cath lab. And so these are the intervals that he used, and they were predicted to do nothing, and they did do nothing. That's why they're not filled in. Okay, so that seemed a little fantastic, but it happened. Now, one of the features of this situation, I think, that's facilitating and that is not in the model, is the fact that we are stimulating in a region of short APD and propagating into a region of long APD. And I think that's going to make a difference for the following reason. Now, you've already heard from Jin-Lin Qiu, who's been looking at this problem in a different way and more analytically. This is more of a conceptual idea. So this is the one that I showed you earlier, where we have alternans in a region where the period is alternating. But if we take the action potential duration of the region that we're propagating into and increase it, there are two manifestations. First is that the amplitude of the alternans is greater, and that then leads to greater cycle length variance, which means that the long action potential, instead of here iterating to some other action potential, here is going to iterate to block. Conversely, if we were to stimulate in the other direction, and then we're now doing that in the real dogs, and we're propagating into a region that has a shorter action potential duration, the amplitude of the alternans is going to be less, and the local variation of period is going to be less, and so instead of going to block, we're simply going to have a lower amplitude of alternans. And I'll give you some experimental data in a minute that suggests that this really is happening. Okay, experimental data involves the effects of verapamil, and Alan has already showed you these data from our inferior group, and what we did was to measure dynamic restitution and then apply verapamil, and it's flattened restitution, and that reduced the amplitude of APD alternans. And interestingly, if you assessed restitution using a standard S1-S2 protocol, you didn't see this effect on restitution. And again, if you take a fibrillating preparation, you expose it to verapamil, this flattening of restitution apparently leads to coalescence of wavefronts and the creation of a single spiral wave. So the real purpose of Marcus Kohler's visit was to try this in whole dogs. And we knew that the dose of verapamil that we were going to have to give was nothing that you would ever want to give an individual, but we wanted sort of proof of concept in an intact heart in a real animal. And so what we did, again, was to anesthetize and instrument these dogs and then give them one of three doses of verapamil. And again, for the clinical people, it did everything that you would think it would do. It reduced the blood pressure. It actually even reduced the heart rate despite the reduction in blood pressure. PR interval increased, and the action potential duration increased. Again, verapamil is a dirty drug. It doesn't just block calcium current, it also blocks HERG. So we had the effects that we expected, and then we had a couple of effects that we didn't expect. One that we did expect was that the restitution, the slope of the APD restitution relation would be flattened, and it was, but not below 1. And if we gave the dogs any more verapamil than we did, they simply went into arrest. However, this flattening or reduction in the slope of the restitution relation was associated with a lack of VF induction using these specific VF protocols. In other words, this S2, 3, 4, 5. So we were able to fibrillate 8 out of the 8 dogs in the absence of verapamil, but the more verapamil we gave, the less we were able to fibrillate using that sequence of numbers. And I think the reason for that is twofold. One is that we are flattening restitution. That was associated with a reduction in the magnitude of the alternans. But we're also changing the conduction time between the right ventricle and the left ventricle. And that, I think, reflects a reduction in the difference between action potential duration during the premature beats between control and after the verapamil. So in other words, the verapamil, by whatever mechanism, is making the APDs more homogeneous. Because they're more homogeneous, that's reducing the conduction slowing as you go from this short right ventricle, short APD right ventricle, into the long APD left ventricle. And if you don't have conduction slowing, then you won't get the discordant alternans. And if you don't have the discordant alternans, it's a lot more difficult then to induce ventricular fibrillation.
After the verapamil, did you regenerate the intervals so to account for changes in the refractory period and all that, or did you use the same?
No, we didn't, because we weren't smart enough to think about that at the time. But we are doing that now, so I'll show you where we're doing that now. Okay, so this is an example of non-induction of VF after the verapamil. And you notice that now the left ventricle and the right ventricle have about the same action potential duration. If you deliver the short to the right it's a little longer in the left. The long one really isn't that much longer than the short one, because again the restitution has been flattened. And so we don't see this long, short pattern that we saw prior to the administration of verapamil. And as I said, it was very difficult in the dogs that had a lot of verapamil to induce BF. Now, of course, a lot of other things are happening in those dogs. Their blood pressures are low, their sinus rates are low. So I'm not going to pretend that this is solely responsible for the lack of induction, but it was a pretty dramatic effect, and it did at least correspond to some of our expectations based on the restitution relations. But these are normal beagle dogs, and they don't fibrillate unless we make them. But we do have access to some dogs that do fibrillate spontaneously, and these are German Shepherd dogs that have been bred by Sidney Moise over the years. And for reasons that we still don't understand, they have a genetic predisposition to sudden cardiac death. And usually they die between 4 and 8 months of age, which is adolescence for a shepherd, typically in sleep or following arousal from sleep. So we had initially thought this might be a model for sudden infant death syndrome, and it still might be. They have a bradycardia-induced or bradycardia-facilitated non-sustained polymorphic ventricular tachycardia. They do not have long QT, and we've measured it every way we can think to measure it. But nevertheless, they have a number of characteristics in their phenotype that are that are similar to patients with long QT. And here you have a run of fairly nasty non-sustained VT. So for many years we were trying to figure out why do these dogs die, and then finally it dawned on us that maybe what we ought to be thinking about is why don't they die. Here they have all of this ectopy, hundreds of thousands of PVCs per day in some of these dogs on a 24-hour Holter. Why haven't they gone into ventricular fibrillation? And so this is the sort of one in a million thing that that Jim was talking about. And in that talk, the idea was the triggers are not activating a permissive substrate. In other words, the substrate has to be right in order for you to get ventricular fibrillation. What I'm going to argue today is sort of the obverse of that, and that is that the substrate's there, but it's the wrong trigger. So what we've done is to measure the intervals between these PVCs and create a library of those, and then go in and deliver, and we do that very simply. We just take episodes of VT and measure the R to R intervals, and then program the stimulator with those. And then we deliver those to the shepherds just to make sure that the anesthesia and the instrumentation and just us delivering stimuli doesn't cause VF. So when we do that, this is the picture you've seen before from the Beagle model. These are the cycle lengths that the dog has been developing spontaneously, some of them, during its non-sustained ventricular tachycardia. And you can see that they're right in the foothills here of this region of vulnerability. So then we stimulated at the cycle lengths that the Beagle model said should produce VF, and it did sometimes, but a lot of times it didn't. And in a way, this was reassuring, because that meant that these dogs, which were obviously different from the Beagles, had something different about their ventricles that was not allowing us to fibrillate them. And it really emphasized the need, as Dave just mentioned, to measure APD restitution at least, if not CV restitution, in an individual animal, take those data and use it to predict which intervals should fibrillate that animal, and then go back into that animal and see whether in fact they do that. So that's what we're in the process of doing now. And Niels has already presented some of this, but a lot of you weren't here the first week, so let me just go over it again. He has a new way to predict or to construct the predictions with respect to which sequences of cycle lengths are going to be arrhythmogenic. And this, the way that this these data are displayed is different from what I've been showing you, but it's the same picture. So the area of red is the area of greatest vulnerability. And what that means is that your S2 stimulus should be very close to refractoriness. The S3 stimulus should be out around 40, 30 milliseconds or so. And then the S4 stimulus should also be quite close to refractoriness. All right, so again, short, long, short. What I haven't shown you is the next long that would initiate then the conduction block. So in some of the German Shepherds, when we take their restitution relations and we plug them into the model, we get this picture. So that tells us that the same intervals that fibrillated the Beagles ought to fibrillate the Shepherds, and it does in about 40% of the Shepherds.
And you think it doesn't in the other 60% because they have some remodeling?
I don't know. I'm going to talk about that. But yeah, I don't. All right, but then if we look at some at a different dog, we get a different picture. So I don't know, Alan, is this the cat under the rug one? I don't know which one you... But here we have a different pattern. So we still need a short one, but then the next two are long. This one's long, and this one's long, and then the S5 is actually short. So this is a different pattern. Instead of short, long, we have short, long, long, short. And we're not really sure where this is coming from in terms of the way that the restitution relations look. And then to get to Colleen's question, in some of the dogs, we get this. And there's a very small window of vulnerability. And this is associated with very flat restitution of AAV, both in the right ventricle and in the left ventricle. And these dogs are incredibly hard to fibrillate, not only with this sequence of stimuli, but if you simply pace these dogs at, with a constant cycle length, you have to pace them down to 90 or 80 millisecond cycle lengths before they fibrillate. And usually their blood pressure's been at zero for about a minute when they finally do fibrillate, so I'm not sure why they're fibrillating. But if I ever am in need of a cardiac transplant, I'm going to try to find one of these dogs and get their heart, because they are just incredible. Well, they do, but that's the other thing. We don't know, in the dogs that die, about 20% of these dogs die, in the dogs that die, what do their restitution relations look like? Well, we haven't prospectively phenotyped these dogs in that way, so we don't know that yet, but that's something we'd like to do. The other thing that this is one of the...
fibrillation threshold?
I'm sorry?
You use a standard fibrillation threshold, a single system, they have a normal PF threshold.
We've only done that in a very limited number of dogs, and we did that back when we were putting in implantable cardioverter defibrillators, and they weren't different. But that was probably 10 years ago on the devices we were putting in with the old ones with the mesh, you had to do open heart and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't the ideal circumstance under which to assess VFT that way.
Catheterization just to look at the resources that there is much part like cardiologists do.
Yes, well, you can talk to Ray about that, because he's been doing that in these dogs, and I don't even know the story, so I can't tell the story. But essentially, Sydney's been bringing some dogs down to Ray. They've been doing the three-dimensional mapping. What we think is going on, and we'll see whether that's really the truth, is that when you look at the left ventricular Purkinje fibers in these dogs, they have lots and lots of EAD-induced triggered activity. And if you look at the right ventricle, it doesn't. And the difference between the left and the right ventricles in these dogs, at least one of the differences, is that the left ventricle is not sympathetically innervated, as it should be, but the right ventricle is. So there's some developmental abnormality where the right sympathetics go into the right ventricle, but the lefts don't go into the left. And if you probe these Purkinje fibers, it's very easy to find a very prolonged repolarization, also lousy coupling. Much of the ectopy that's being generated by the Purkinje fiber doesn't get out into the muscle because it doesn't get out of the Purkinje fiber. Now, these dogs also have other abnormalities of calcium cycling. Mike Rosen has shown that they are very easy to induce delayed after depolarizations in the muscle. Charlie Anselovich now has been looking at calcium transients, and they apparently have very leaky SR. So these dogs have it's sort of amazing that they have this very severe clinical phenotype in terms of the arrhythmias, but as far as their anatomy and their contractility and their longevity, if they get past this age of vulnerability, is normal, so far as we can tell. So I don't know, Ray, did you want to say anything about the mapping in these dogs? Is it too soon? Or
I think it's too soon, and it's really Sydney's study, so
okay.
We should, but things are consistent with what you just said.
Yeah. So what we don't know is what's sustaining these arrhythmias. I'm pretty convinced that the initiator is the triggered activity. And as you heard from Leon, I mean, with the heart prints, you can get another sort of suggestive index of that just based on the sensitivity of these rhythms to sinus rate and that kind of thing. And the fact that you have these bigeminal rhythms with fixed coupling. Okay, so Colleen left, so now I can answer your question. And that is, what's going on here? Why? I mean, we've studied a lot of beagles, and none of them have flat restitution. So why are these shepherds showing this? Maybe it's the way we're measuring it, maybe we're not in the right place. There are a lot of technical reasons why this could be happening. But it does raise a larger, a little more fairy tale kind of question, and that is there some chance that the ventricles in these dogs are recognizing that they're under this barrage of ectopy, and they have remodeled in such a way that the ectopy now is no longer able to initiate ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation as it would be most likely if this were a dog with a normal ventricular myocardium such as the Beagles. So we have absolutely no idea how those two could be coupled, but I was talking to Bill Stevenson about this too in terms of patients, you know, post-MI who have lots of ectopy. It's the same kind of thing. They died Tuesday, why didn't they die Monday, etc. And again, very complex situation. So we know there are changes in substrate in these individuals that evolve over time, but maybe there's some remodeling going on in response to this ectopy that is actually protecting them. So let me end then with this potential implication. I'm going to sort of stick my neck out here, but I guess that's what we're here for. And that is, if the form of the APD and CV restitution relations are known, predictions can be made with respect to which sequences of premature stimuli will precipitate conduction block and perhaps VF. So in the simplest way of thinking about this, if you can take a restitution relation from two places in a dog heart and predict which sequences of stimuli are going to fibrillate that heart, that would, well, first of all, it's probably not going to happen. But if it continues to happen the way that it has, what that means is that you could have a device that would measure those things, which are easy to measure, and would then have the algorithm on board so that it would generate the predictions. And you could update these hourly if you wanted to, in case the person was asleep or shoveling snow or doing whatever they do. And if they fired the first two, say, intervals in a sequence that could be malignant, then you would interrupt that sequence with a pacemaker stimulus. You wouldn't need defibrillatory stimulus. You wouldn't even need Farfield. You could just deliver a pacemaker stimulus that would then interrupt that sequence and presumably then keep them from developing ventricular fibrillation. Now, obviously, there are a lot of things that could go wrong with that, not the least of which is where are you going to deliver the stimulus and those kinds of things. But that's what's sort of keeping us moving in this direction, which didn't seem like a good place to go initially, but the results keep coming back fairly positive, so we keep moving where the data take us. And we, by we, I mean all the people that I've already talked about, as well as Sidney Moise and Anna Geltzer. They're the cardiologists who do the whole dog studies with a little help from me. Mark Riccio is an engineer who's helping with the modeling as well as the whole animal studies. Jeff Fox is a modeler who's now at Gene Network Sciences. Marcus Kohler is the cardiologist who's in Würzburg. And you know this fellow, Niels.
He's by the lake in Ithaca.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, what makes this worse, you know, I mean, it's bad enough he's on the beach, but this isn't even Santa Barbara. This is Hawaii, and that's where he was a week before he came here. So he's been on the beach for a month. I don't know what's going on. So anyway, Niels has been very instrumental in this, and you know that this is a stage picture because he would never take his laptop out where there's sand. So. I know. So, all right, that's all I have.
So, when you do the same pacing as Gautier with the dynamic and S1, S2, to sort of evaluate the importance of memory,
mm-hmm. Yeah, we have. And we started out thinking that we need to incorporate all of that into the algorithm, and we probably will still do that, but luckily Niels came up with a simpler way to make these predictions. So if the predictions hold, then we can do it without actually having to accommodate all of that information, which would make life simpler. I'm not sure it's going to make it more realistic.
Is it working?
No.
The
dynamic. Yeah, the S1, S2, we weren't able to get good predictions from that. Yeah, and the dynamic that we generate is with Jeff's memory model, so it has memory. And if you perturb it using these cycle lengths, then you get something that approximates what you see in the restitution of portrait. But quantitatively, it's not exactly the same. The other thing that we found with we're doing the restitution portrait in the shepherds as well, and you find that when you do that in the shepherds, they have some different responses compared to the normal beagle. So it isn't just simply a non-subtle difference between the two groups of dogs. There is something else that's going on there. Yeah.
What kind of the top activity is are the German shepherd dogs? I mean, is it a rapid firing or just one activity every now and then?
It depends on the dogs. Some of them have very sustained bigeminy. Some of them have nothing. Some of them have what I showed on that one slide, which is, you know, salvos of reasonably rapid ventricular tachycardia. But it's not a long, short sequence. Now, as luck would have it, we've only caught three of these dogs with a Holter on when they died or with a reveal unit in. So we really don't have a good idea yet what the sequences are that actually do kill them. The three we have, it fits with the theory, but it's three, and you have only these unipolar recordings, so I'm not real confident that we have enough data to say anything with that. The other thing, let me just say that the other reason we're interested in these dogs is that now finally we have the dog genome, so we're able to try to establish the genetic basis for this, and it's complicated, unfortunately. But these dogs presumably all have the same genotype, but they have wide spectrum of phenotypes. As I said, some of the dogs don't have any ectopy, some have a lot of ectopy. Not all of them die. Once they get past about 8 months of age, they get better. Their ectopy goes away. I think we know why that is. So perhaps this is a model for long QT in the sense not that they have long QT, but in long QT, of course, the people all have the same genotype, but you have a wide spectrum of phenotypes. And why is that? Environmental factors. We think probably catecholamines inducing gene expression have something to do with that, but it might be a useful model to try to tease that out. Yeah, Jim?
Same thing about, you know, applying this type of reason clinically basically in animal models that require the non experimentation type model. Mm-hmm. You know, in a normal person, of course, it's hard to induce BF with pacing rapidly. Mm-hmm. You're kind of setting it up to produce discordant alternates and get conduction block
right
in order to initiate that.
Yep.
But in disease parts, there's a lot of intrinsic heterogeneity and it's greatly amplified. So, for example, David's data on the transmural heterogeneity in the
right
dog model with a quick pace cardiomyopathy. And there, I would imagine the restitution is going to vary a lot regionally. And it'd be really curious or interesting if under those, in that kind of model, whether you could sample two sites and kind of predict the sequence from that. But I also, you know, I think that in this case, you need four beats or something in order to.
Well, it's easier with four, yeah. You can do it with one.
Know which is the PVC and which is the start of the rotor. I guess that's the question in a patient with
heart. Yeah, so obviously I've said nothing about where these VT beats would come from. And I don't know. In the shepherds, we're pretty sure they're coming from EAD-induced triggered activity. So that's one possibility. But the rotor could have already started, and that's what's causing these first four beats. And in that case, if we point stimulate, we're probably not going to stop anything. You can make the argument that if the arrhythmias are ischemia-induced, that it's not really the ischemic myocardium that's the problem there. It's the rest of the normal myocardium that's fibrillating. Because the ischemic myocardium is going to be more difficult to drive rapidly than the normal myocardium. So maybe if you just find out what's going in the normal myocardium, that'll be sufficient. That's probably not the case, but at least it's possible. So, Igor?
It seems like when we draw the electrogram, I saw that it's another block of the initial reason for the bradycardia.
I'm sorry, say that again.
It's another block.
Ah.
So have you looked at that, say, what's the reason?
Yeah, so these dogs, as you know, in dogs, there's a lot of sinus arrhythmia anyway. And these dogs have accentuated sinus arrhythmia. So you don't need AV block in order to set up these long pauses. They will do that, just their sinus node will. And it doesn't look like there's sinoatrial block. So we have done some hispundyl studies on these dogs, and you can demonstrate that they just have very slow sinus rates sometimes. Yeah. But you can find lots of places where there are P waves just at very long intervals. And that, you know, one of the, these dogs start to get their arrhythmias at 4 months of age, which is when their heart rate also starts to show the most variability. So when they're younger, they don't have as much heart rate variability, they're just fast all the time, and we don't see the arrhythmias.
Yeah, can I
have go ahead, sure.
It relates to your mechanism.
In humans, look at the AV node. So one of the signatures of dual populated physiology in the AV node, which is an indication of vulnerability to AV NRP, is that you have in your convection curve, when you stimulate the AV node, sensing the convection time versus this one, so you get essentially delay of stepwise function.
Right.
And, but in many patients, in rabbits including, it's actually not necessarily there. You don't necessarily have to jump, but you do have. But if you apply S1, S2, S3, S4 protocol, I've seen a couple of studies in humans, you can actually reproducibly get this jump in every single patient. And I wonder if in some way, if you look at this literature and if mechanism is similar to what you could.
Yeah, so you wonder whether they're inducing block in one place and not in another.
Yeah, well, idea is essentially you switch between slow and fast pathway.
Right.
Because they have different distribution
codes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting. Yeah, and their ectopy goes down. We think that it requires a certain combination of vagal and sympathetic stimulation. The time of day that they are most ectopic is during REM sleep. So we did a study where we got some poor vet students to
watch the dogs
and take them sleeping, and then watch the videos later and correlate it with the ECGs. And the dogs, you can tell when they're in REM sleep, they really do have rapid eye movements. So during sleep, of course, there's a lot of vagal tone, but during REM sleep, there's probably sympathetic tone superimposed upon that, and that may be the same situation when they wake up from sleep, because usually they wake up because it's time to eat, and so they get excited about that. Speaking of which, okay, one more. I'm sorry. Yeah.
We don't know
what's cause and effect here. We don't even really know whether the left ventricles get innervated initially and then the innervation recedes over time. The way that we look at the innervation is using MIDG scintigraphy. So the nerves are supposed to light up if they're there, and if they don't, if they're not there, they don't. So we looked at some really young animals, and it looks like going all the way back to early neonatal age, they don't have sympathetic innervation. Now, does that have anything to do with their electrophysiology? I don't know. One thing that we have documented is that these dogs have a markedly reduced ITO in the left ventricle, which is denervated, but not in the right ventricle, which is not. And I forget whether David Rosenbaum, somebody was talking about ITO being a very labile current. And in fact, I wrote something once that you don't know whether it's the canary in the mine shaft, where this is the first thing to go wrong and you want to pay attention, or whether it's a red herring and it's just, this current is so expendable that in the first sign of trouble, the cells get rid of it. But we did do some studies to show that if you take the myocytes from these dogs that don't have ITO and you culture them with sympathetic stimulation, they do get expression of ITO. So there's some suggestion that the denervation here is in at least somehow connected with lack of a trophic effect on ITO expression. And maybe this is having something to do with their calcium channel or their calcium metabolism abnormalities as well, but we don't know. Okay. All righty. Lunch.
Thank you, guys.